Okay, so I want to thank the organizers for letting me give a talk. So I want to talk about work which was done in collaboration with a student at Caltech, Shankar Iyer, Brian Clark, who is actually a postdoc here, Eugene Demler, and Bill Raphael. And our goal is to understand both ground and excited states of many-body interacting systems in the presence of quench disorder. So kind of we understand interacting systems sort of without disorder. Now what happens when we add disorder? So this is kind of a methods talk. So what is this real space RG method? So it's easiest to maybe explain it by giving an example. So let's look at the transverse field one-dimensional Ising chain. This was called by Daniel Fisher essentially in 92 using this method. This is based on ideas of Dasgupta and Ma and Bhatt and Lee. So we have our Hamiltonian, which has Ising couplings on neighboring sides and a transverse field. So here is schematically a picture of the Hamiltonian. On each side, we have some transverse field, the red arrow, and the strength of coupling is indicated by the thickness of the bond. Now suppose that the biggest coupling in the system is this bond Ji. In this case, what the RG does is it says that the two spins, two Ising spins on these two sides lock together and move together. So in effect, we can take these two sides and replace it by one effective side on which the magnetic field, local magnetic field, is diminished. Similarly, if the biggest coupling is a magnetic field somewhere, we can say that the spin is locked to the magnetic field. And then we can remove this site in perturbation theory and get an effective coupling between the neighboring sites. Now, what does this kind of RG do? Well, basically, here we have a competition between J's and H's. And if J's are stronger, then we do more of this kind of decimation. This tends to make H's weaker, so J's win, and we get a J-dominant phase. On the other hand, we can have the opposite effect, where H dominate. And in between, we have a critical point, a quantum critical point, where we find power law distributions of J's and H's. And Daniel's nice contribution was to figure out the flow equation for these distributions and thus understand this critical point. Now, what are the motivations for our work? Well, kind of the original motivation is to look at dilute helium-4 in Vicor, which is supposed to make some sort of Bose glass. Here is a kind of a schematic picture. Then there are lots of motivations in cold atoms. There are starting with this experiment of Greiner and company in 2002 that realized the transition between bosonic superfluid and Mott insulator. There has been a lot of work to try to introduce disorder into this problem and see what happens. So here is kind of schematic picture of disorder from this paper of White et al. In Brian DeMarco's group. Then there is question of granular superconductors. Here is a picture from this Budim paper, which is in Nandini-Trivedi's group, that looks at the transition in granular superconductors, and also there are some ideas in spin systems. Now here is the outline for the talk. First, I will look at ground state beyond one dimension, and then in the second part, I will try to go beyond the ground state and look at the excited states, many-body excited states of the system using the strong disorder RG method. So first, let me make some introductions about what happens when we add disorder to phase transition and introduce this Harris criterion. Next, I will look at this anomalous sliding phase that occurs in disordered layered superfluids, and also the superfluid to mod glass transition in 2D. So let's go ahead and get started. So what happens to phase transitions in the presence of disorder? Well, one way to think about it is through this Harris criterion. So what Harris criterion does is it tells us whether disorder is important or not. Basically, as we approach the phase transition, we have some coherence links over which the order parameter can fluctuate, which is given by distance to the critical point to the power mu. What we want to ask is, as we approach the phase transition, does the fluctuations in disorder get stronger or weaker compared to the distance of the phase transition? And this is a Harris criterion. So we compare the fluctuations of delta r averaged over the size that the order parameter can fluctuate to the distance to the transition to r. And this gives us condition if d nu is greater than 2, the disorder is irrelevant, and if d nu is less than 2, the disorder is relevant. So what does this mean? Well, if you have a clean system with some transition GC here, then if disorder is irrelevant, then the transition survives. If disorder is relevant, then the transition is broken, and we get we have some possibilities. So one possibility is we form a new phase transition with GC prime, and typically in the vicinity of this transition we also get these Griffiths phases. So what's a Griffiths phase? Well, for example, if we look at the disordered side, here we have some sizable inclusions of the other ordered phase.
I'm not sure I understand the idea. The idea is that you want to look if the disorder is self-averaging in a region the size
of psi. Exactly.
Or
more precisely, when we average the disorder and look at how strong is the deviation, is it bigger or smaller than the distance of to the transition? Right, so what is this delta R, right? Well, it's psi the area to the half power. So this is where the d over 2 comes from. And then the rest is clear.
This is a perturbative criterion.
This only answers the question of systems with weak disorder.
So what's the next order of perturbation theory? Is there a chance the next order of perturbation theory is somehow weaker but more, but gives you a different criterion at all? Something I always wondered.
I don't know what you.
Okay.
Yeah, presumably strong disorder can break this criterion.
Well, the worry is that it breaks into weak disorder. Okay.
Okay, so one other possibility is we can make a smeared phase transition. So this is particularly likely to happen if our little regions, disordered regions, have a large dimensionality. So we will look at the case where our rare regions have dimension 2, which is the same as the lower critical dimension for the transition we have in mind, and we will show that this leads to smearing of the phase transition. So let me go ahead and introduce this elusive sliding phase. What we look at is a transition between superfluid and the normal fluid in a 3D system composed of superfluid pancakes. So this was really inspired by these two works in cold atom physics, and this is a kind of a picture from this work. What they did is they made a 1D disorder optic lattice. This is this blue stuff, which basically splits up the fluid into pancakes, kind of schematically shown here, and this red tube provides axial confinement, so the pancake has some finite diameter. So now we have this pancakes, and we have possibly tunneling between them, and we want to understand what is the transition, how the fluid goes from superfluid to normal fluid as we go from low temperature to high temperature. One interesting story is that when we were working on this, it turned out that my PhD advisor, Paul Goldbart, was actually working on the same problem without telling us. And then we met Thomas Voigt at the March meeting, and we kind of collaborated on getting our papers submitted at the same time, and you can see that they're back to back. They differ by one page number.
They are functional or?
They are partially orthogonal. We looked at this using strong disorder RG, and those guys look at it from the point of view of Lifshitz tails. So what is a sliding phase and why is it elusive? So consider a two-layer model. So this is one superfluid, another superfluid. Now what we want to have is the following. We want this to be really a superfluid, so it's stiff between psi 1 and psi 2, and this guy is stiff between psi 3 and psi 4. But we want that there to be no coupling between upper fluid and lower fluid. So kind of the Josephson effect between them has to be zero, so there is no stiffness between psi 2 and psi 4. So what does this require? Well, this requires that Josephson coupling becomes small, but also that the vortex fugacity becomes small in each superfluid, so it becomes a superfluid. Now, why is this a problem? Well, let's look at kind of the typical flow diagram for these quantities for J and zeta as a function of superfluid stiffness or maybe temperature. So here I plot kind of temperature or superfluid stiffness. So here is cold, so K is large. Here is hot, so K is small. Now, in the cold side, Josephson coupling increases, vortex fugacity decreases, which means that vortices become less and less likely, and coupling between the two layers becomes stronger and stronger. So no sliding phase. In the middle, the Josephson coupling still increases, but now zeta also increases. So basically, we have a competition, and if Josephson coupling wins, we get coupled layers, and if zeta wins, then we get two normal fluid layers. And at the very hot regime, Josephson coupling is no longer relevant, but zeta is relevant, so we always get normal fluid. So what do we want? Well, we want to kind of reverse this picture. So we want to find some tuning parameter to make these both point down and achieve a sliding phase. Now, for two layers, I have no idea how to do this. Maybe Vadim has some ideas. But for a multi-layer system, we can actually do this using disorder. So what is the model we are considering? Well, suppose we have lots of superfluid layers. In each layer, the layer is translationally invariant. And each layer we can describe by some superfluid stiffness ki. And vortex fugacity zeta, which is just the probability to have a vortex. And also there is some coupling between each pair of layers. And each ji, zeta I, and ki can be different. Now, what do we expect to happen? Well, if there is no disorder, what we expect is a standard 3dx-like phase transition. So if we plot something like superfluid stiffness as a function of temperature, both the in-plane and out-of-plane superfluid stiffnesses should go to zero at the same point. And how do we understand this? Well, we can rescale the in-plane direction until the system becomes uniform, and then we are back to 3D scaling. Now, what about quench disorder? Well, if we add quench disorder, then we can think of it kind of as some layers being weak, some layers being strong. So what happens is that we get superfluid puddles out of the strong layers, which are weakly connected to each other through the weak layers. Basically, the weak layers form a blockading regions, which prevent supercurrent actually from flowing across the stack in the vertical direction. So how do we explain this using renormalization group? Well, we came up with this kind of two-step process. So in step one, we do momentum space on each layer. So on each layer, we do Berezinski Kostel-Saus type flow and modify the k, zeta, and j. And the second step, if one of the couplings, a zeta or a j, becomes strong, we go ahead and do a real space RG step where we either merge layers or get rid of a layer. So more explicitly, suppose that coupling between these two, the Josephson coupling between two layers has become large, then what we want to do is we want to take this layer and merge them into one super layer. When we do this, the superfluid stiffnesses add and the vortex fugacities multiply. Similarly, if some layer has a large vortex fugacity, then it basically becomes a normal layer, so we can forget about keeping track of it. We can get an effective coupling for layer below it to the layer above it, and the effective coupling is just the product of the two couplings. Okay, now schematically, how does this RG run? So this actually took a little pain to figure out what are the right coordinates to use. And eventually, we figured out that k and zeta are related to each other, because each time we merge layers, both k and zeta get modified. So we should look at joint probability distribution for k and zeta. And also, we should keep track of the probability distribution for the Josephson couplings. Now, what does the RG do? Well, for Josephson couplings, basically, in the regime we are interested, it just makes Josephson couplings stronger and stronger. So all these points flow up. Now, what about the vortex fugacity? Well, it depends on the value of k. If k is small, the vortex fugacities flow this way, and if k is large, it flows up. Now, what happens if vortex fugacity, if z flows down, that means vortex fugacity is increasing, it can eventually reach zero. Now, what happens if a vortex if a vortex fugacity reaches zero, that means we have to eliminate a layer and multiply two j's to get the effective j to couple the layer above it and below it. So we take two layers.
And can you remind what is capital K?
K is a superfluid stiffness. So this is a distribution of superfluid stiffnesses as function of vortex fugacity with this kind of strange log that you always see in strong disorder RG. Yeah, please do ask questions.
Oh, wait, I'm confused. When Z is reduced, that means that you have a superfluid layer.
When this Z is reduced, that means zeta becomes 1, so you have a normal layer.
Oh, it's here.
Yeah, this is a trouble with this notation, but it's convenient because you can add instead of multiplying.
So vortex fugacity is density of vortices. So, is it a different fugacity?
Huh?
When the vortex fugacity goes to 0,
there are no vortices.
Is it a normal layer?
No. Vortex fugacity is going up.
Ah.
Z is going down. Zeta is going up.
Z is not the fugacity.
Z is not fugacity. Zeta is fugacity.
Okay.
Right? So if you take if you take a point in this distribution, it's on this side, it flows down, and eventually Z becomes 0 or zeta becomes 1. At this point, this layer is normal. We have to get rid of it. So how do we get rid of it? Well, we couple it to the layer above it and below it. So how do we do it? Well, suppose this is a J for the layer above, J for the layer below. So we just add these two J's. And we take two points out of this distribution and make a new point. Similarly.
Sorry, what is the starting distribution of data in this?
So we tried all sorts of distributions, and it essentially doesn't matter, as long as it's bounded. It has to be a bounded distribution, because otherwise we will break the system if we have some coupling which is zero. So we used truncated Gaussian, like inverse parabola, upside down parabola, and top hat distributions.
Basically, they all broaden?
They all broaden and become power laws.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of on the next slide. Now, what happens if some J becomes strong, so these points keep moving up, so one point can reach the end of the graph. In this case, we have to merge two layers. That means we take two layers from this distribution and we just add the vectors. Right, so we remove those two points and make a new point, which is at the tip of the added vectors. Now, how does this flow work? Well, there are kind of two epochs. In the first epoch, both layer mergers and decimations happen, and we obtain power law distribution in all three parameters, in J, in zeta, and in K. And in the second epoch, the zeta and the k exponent go to zero, while the j exponent saturates at whatever its final value. Now, why are there two epochs? Well, when two layers merge, the superfluid stiffness increases because we added two superfluid stiffnesses of the incoming layers. So we create stronger superfluid layers. On the other hand, when decimations occur, we do not decrease k, so no new weak layers get created. So as the system runs through epoch one, it essentially burns out all the weak layers, so only strong layers are left. And then we transition to this epoch. And how do we see it? Well, we can plot the exponent as a function of RG time. So here are the three exponents, the k exponent, the zeta exponent, and j exponent. What we see is that initially all three of them flow. And then finally, one the j exponent saturates, and the zeta and k exponent go to zero. Depending on temperature, the final saturation value for the j exponent can be different. And one important thing to note is new j becomes smaller than 1, then the effective coupling between the top and bottom layers becomes very, very weak, and we can no longer support the supercurrent on the c-axis. So we enter the sliding phase.
Is there some kind of relationship between combinations of these exponents?
So I wish I would know an answer to your question. Unfortunately, we were only able to solve these equations numerically. So we wrote down the flow equation for the distribution function, and we just solve them and then fit the exponents.
What's the sort of largest value of inverse nu j that you need?
Largest value?
Of inverse nu j. Of smallest value of nu j.
Oh, zero.
You can move on the way. I thought it's actually a finite value.
Let me answer this question by plotting kind of a schematic flow diagram. So what do we have is the axes don't mean anything. This is the diagram really schematic. But what do we find? We find the following. We find a superfluid fixed point, a normal fixed point, and this Griffith's phase in between the two fixed points. So what do these guys correspond to? Well, the normal fixed point here, it means that we have decimated all the links, all the sides. Now, on the other hand, what does the superfluid fixed point mean? Well, it means that we have merged all the sides. Now, in between, what we find is kind of two Griffith's phases in which we get the power law distribution of coupling between the different J's. And depending on where we are along this line, we can either have a superfluid stiffness on C axis, which is finite, or zero. So right as we approach normalized synthesis, the case where nu j goes to zero. Sorry, the intelligence is inversely proportional to direction to distance to the screen, and I'm pretty close.
One more question. In that picture that you just showed,
yes?
What's the significance of the color change?
Right. So this part is when nu j is bigger than 1, and this part is when it's smaller than 1.
So on phase transition at that point.
There is no phase transition there, but the response of the system qualitatively changes. So here it has a superfluid response on C axis, and here it doesn't.
So it's not a superfluid to, you know, metal or insulator transition
no.
at that point?
No. But this is just the fact that if you measure some property of the distribution function, it can become zero.
Sorry, I'm just confused. So if I just, in your phase diagram, if I pin the phase on the topmost layer,
yes.
I simply ask,
You're asking about correlations.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
This is different, and I will answer your question in 2 slides.
Right.
So to check what's going on, we did some numerics to verify that we actually have a sliding phase. So to do numerics, we look at the layer XY model, where each layer has its own JZ parallel and JZ perp, the coupling in plane and between the planes. So we took top hat distributions. And the first question to ask is what happens when we are at an extremum of the distribution. So suppose that we take the smallest possible values. In this case, if we plot the superfluid stiffness as a function of temperature calculated using classical Monte Carlo, with the help of Brian Clark, we get this curve for the in-plane stiffness, this curve for the out-of-plane stiffness, and you see they both go to zero at the same point. We can do the same for the maximum value of the distribution. They go to zero at a different point. Now, what happens when we order? Well, here is the result. Superfluid stiffness as a function of temperature. Now, this point was the maximal point. This point was the minimal point. And what we see is that the out-of-plane stiffness goes to zero at some value, 3 on the scale, while the in-plane stiffness goes to zero kind of continuously, and it reaches zero only here at the maximal point. So indeed supporting the fact that between 3 and 4, there is a sliding phase where we have no stiffness on C axis and stiffness in the plane.
When rho C goes to 0, that is a phase transition?
No, it's not. No.
Why is it not? That's what's confusing.
Because rho c is just expectation value of sum of 1 over j's. So to the stiffness is not a correlator. Right? It's just an expectation value. It's a response to the twist. So what we find is that there will be no response to the twist, but there will still be off diagonal long range order. It's superfluid with zero stiffness. So this gets us to this point. What happened to Josephson relation? Right, so Josephson relation tells us that off diagonal long range order and superfluid stiffness are related. Now, of course, we know this is not true, but we always kind of thought that at least the arrow this way is okay. But now we see that the arrow this way is also not okay. So here is numerical data supporting this statement. So here, to the previous plot, I also add the plot of the correlation function between the furthest layers in the system. And what I see is that the correlation function indeed goes to zero, but it doesn't become zero when the stiffness becomes zero. It kind of becomes zero in a very double exponential way as it approaches the upper point. So what happened? Well, we used to have a phase transition. This phase transition has become completely smeared. We have no longer any power loss associated with the phase transition. And we also have this kind of interesting change of regimes where we go from stiffness on C-axis to no stiffness on C-axis.
How do your results depend on system size, do you?
So we certainly studied it systematically in RG, right? We can take more and more layers and do numerical RG. Here we did not study it very systematically. This is part of the reason it's not published. We are trying to work on it, but we are lazy.
Busy is the writer.
Okay, busy is the writer. by comparison to RG, I would expect that kind of the finite size scaling would just round this thing over. So as you go to larger and larger systems, it would go to zero sharper and sharper.
So superfluid stiffness, so here you're studying it as mean of 1 over j's or something like this, but you could also just look at the correlation function.
But it's different. So correlation function
is here.
This is a correlation function. This is e to the I theta 1 minus theta n.
No, but I could look at a current
curve.
I can't mind making a very clean way the superfluid stiffness.
Yeah, you can look at the twist correlation function, right? Then you get the superfluid stiffness.
And that's exactly your sum of k.
Is it sum of 1 over j?
Yes.
But then why do you say there's no phase transition if there's the singularity in the response?
Well,
the current.
Because it's response, it's not correlation function.
No, no. I mean,
well, okay. Point taken.
And the KT transition, it's rho s going to z1, that's the KT transition.
Yeah, yes. So
why is this not like that?
Well, because there is still long range order.
In the other?
Yes.
But in the plane? Someone in the plane?
No, there is long range order both between the planes and in the plane.
But I mean, the definition of a phase transition isn't whether you have long range order or not, it's whether one has through a singularity or not, right?
Yeah.
And this to me looks very singular.
Okay, yes.
Isn't that smoothly vanishing? There's no.
So this one is vanishing not smoothly, it's from RG.
In the RG,
but in numerics?
Well, in numerics, it's rounded over by finite size.
It looks like it's very sort of slow.
Well, this one is vanishing smoothly. It's vanishing like some 1 over exponential.
Yes. One more question, sorry. So since the thing seems to rely on the RG sort of saying it's vanishing sharply.
Yes.
As I understood it, there's no infinite disorder fixed point. Here it's a finite but large disorder fixed point.
Yes.
So depending on the RG is making some. So I mean, what I'm saying, how much do you trust the RG in
some case? So the point about.
You say a Griffith's fixed point, not a infinite.
This is a Griffith's fixed point, right?
What about that one?
This one is not a fixed point. I mean,
if I'm in that region of the phase,
yes, if I'm here,
there's some fixed point in your logic that controls the.
No, there is no fixed point. So all that happens is distribution of J changes from like 1 over J to the 1 plus epsilon to the 1 over J to the 1 minus epsilon.
Okay, that's finite disorder, right? I mean, finite mid-term distribution.
In the sense that you can't renormalize the distribution. In the sense you can't normalize the distribution.
Oh, so it goes to 1 over J?
Is this just like the Griffiths sort of region?
No, it's the same one. Yeah.
So
1 minus 1 over Z is how you
would
write it.
Right. 1 minus nu J, right?
Yeah.
And nu J goes from 1 plus epsilon to 1 minus epsilon.
1 plus epsilon?
So it goes through flat distribution.
Ah, so that's actually very weak in the sense of breadth of distributions. That's very weak disorder.
Yes.
And so the RG is making a finite error. In distributions like this. You trust the RG if UJ is going to zero?
Yes. Okay, let me check what UJ actually does, but I think it's around 1 that it has problems. Because this is where 1 over J average becomes undefined, right?
No. Do you mean 1 plus epsilon or just epsilon?
Yeah, exactly.
Also, the question is where does probability of J.
The thing that you can't normalize is 1 over J.
Look at your rotation.
I think maybe you just mean epsilon. You don't mean 1 plus epsilon in that.
Oh, maybe, yes.
Yeah, maybe.
Or erase the 1 above.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, so then that's an infinite disorder.
Yeah, I think so disorder is.
And so the meaning of epsilon going to zero is there some logs in the denominator or something?
Yes.
Give you a strong disorder response.
Yeah, and this is why we get decoupling. Right, we have so many weak layers that basically the smallest J is so weak that we don't couple. By the way, this Voita and Goldbart and company come up with the same conclusions. Another problem is this 2D superfluid to mode glass transition, and I suppose this picture has been shown in the conference many times. This is a phase diagram of the Bose-Hubbard model. So on this axis, we plot the chemical potential as function of J. And what we are interested in is to go from the superfluid to the mode insulator, but in the presence of disorder. So in their seminal paper, Fisher, Weichmann, Greenstein, and Fisher postulated that there should be some Bose glass that is intermediate between the superfluid and the mode insulator. So to understand what are the different phases, I just kind of made a table summarizing their properties. So in superfluid, we have off-diagonal long-range order. It's compressible and it's gapless. Mode insulator is none of the above. Bose glass has no long-range order, but it's compressible and gapless. And actually, the phase that we will look at today is this mode glass, which has no long-range order, which is incompressible as opposed to Bose glass, which is compressible and is gapless. And our results are kind of similar to this quantum Monte Carlo paper of Prokofiev and Svistunov, and they're published here.
Where are the other four logical possibilities?
I will present a table of all the possible glasses, which I guess is what we're interested in. To have long-range order and be incompressible and gap is kind of strange to me, but you can think about it. And today we will concentrate on working only along this line where we have particle hole symmetry. Now, what is the model? Well, the model was written down on the previous page, but let's rewrite it in slightly different form, in the form of a quantum rotor model. This is following this paper of Alvin and company, which did the RG in one dimension. So what we basically do is we replace the creation operator by e to the I phi times the density, and this results in this kind of model where sides are cosine coupled, and there is a charging energy, and the phi and the n are conjugate variables. Now, physically, what does this model look like? Well, we can think of this as an array of superfluid puddles, which are Josephson coupled to each other. So here are the puddles. The lines between them indicate the coupling. This plunger here indicates the offset charge, the delta N. And the size of the grain is related to its charging energy, to the U. So how does the RG work? Well, first, let's get rid of the plungers, of the offset charges, to make life a little easier. Now, what happens in RG? Suppose this grain has the largest U, so it's actually the smallest, right? Because smaller capacitor has larger charging energy. So what we can do is we can get rid of this grain and get effective coupling between its neighboring grains in second order perturbation theory, just the same as we did for Ising model in the beginning. Similarly, if the strongest coupling is a Josephson coupling between the two grains, then the phases on these two grains lock together, and we should replace it by a single effective grain. Now, what do these flows look like? So this is actually kind of a problem because we have this multidimensional distribution. So what do we plot? So eventually, we decided to plot the following. The variation of J over the mean of J on this axis, and mean of J over mean of U on this axis. So what does this axis mean? Well, if you go up, the variation of J becomes stronger. So this is more disorder and less disorder. And this axis, if you go towards this side, we get larger J's. So this is more superfluid, and this is more insulating. Now what we do is we start with a truncated Gaussian distribution, both J and U, and plot the flow. So initial distribution is here, 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 and so on. And we basically find two kinds of flows, some flow up and to the left, and the other kind of flow down and to the right. So these guys we want to identify as superfluid, and these guys we want to identify as not superfluid. And we suppose that there is some fixed point in between the flows. Now, if you start with some different distribution, basically the flows look very similar, but now they're coming down. So to summarize this data, we suggest that there is an unstable fixed point, and that we have flows which go up and to the left to the insulating phase, and down and to the right to the superfluid phase. Now, this fixed point is a finite amount of disorder, so it's again a finite disorder critical point. So your trust in RG is up to you. But I want to present evidence that it might not be so bad. So we tried first to check if it's universal. So we used all kinds of initial distribution functions, Gaussians, flat, power law, bimodal. And what we find is basically independent of what the initial distribution function is, the distribution function after some flow towards this critical point becomes the same. So here is an example of distribution function for the J's and the distribution functions for the U's. So, right, so what we do is basically we pick a flow that flows as close as possible to this fixed point and then plot the distribution functions for it. And here are the distribution functions starting from different initial distribution functions. You see in the end they all become very similar power laws, and similar thing happens to the U distribution functions. Now, what is the RG actually doing, and how do we understand the phases? Well, if you're in superfluid phase, basically what RG is doing is it connecting all the sides. Sometimes it might decimate a side, but mostly it's just connecting the sides. So in the end, we get the superfluid cluster which spans the system. What happens on the mod side? Well, on the mod side, we just decimate all the sides. And in between, we get something in between. We get some superfluid puddles. We decimate some sites. But we, importantly, we don't have a spanning cluster. Now, what about these four possibilities? Well, I'm not going to list all of them, but I'm going to list some of them. And this is the three types of glass. So what kind of glass can we have? Well, let's look at, again, at this quantum rotor model, and let's just forget about the first term in the model and concentrate on properties of this term. And here we see that particle hole symmetry, or the value of delta n, becomes very important. So generically, if you plot the spectrum of this guy, we get this picture. We have some states, and there is always some charging energy. So some, because delta n usually is some value, typically less than a half, say. Now, what about if we have particle hole symmetry? We can do this in two ways. We can set delta n to be half, or we can set delta n to be zero. In case it's half, we get this random singlet glass, and this is a supercompressible glass locally, because the energy for zero bosons on site and one boson per site is the same. On the other hand, in our case, we set delta n equals zero, so we always have a charging energy on each side, so the glass becomes incompressible, although it can still be gapless. So indeed, let's look at at whether our glass is compressible or not. So what we do is we plot the distribution function for the gaps as function of the gap size in the glassy regime. So when the gaps are big, we find lots of them. And as we go towards smaller and smaller gaps, we find that the probability to find these smaller gaps is becoming smaller and smaller. And therefore, the system is incompressible. So it's stronger than at least the power law, this log log plot.
Excuse me, maybe stupid question, but why you say gapless for this?
Because we still have finite probability to find arbitrarily large, arbitrarily small gap or arbitrarily large cluster. But the problem is that these clusters are very, very rare. So there are not enough of them to support the system being compressible. Okay, so to understand this, let's remember percolation theory. So in percolation theory, we basically connect sites with bonds. If the density of bonds is small, we have no spanning cluster. If the density of bonds is high, we have a spanning cluster, as indicated by the red line. And in between, we have a percolation threshold where the spanning cluster first appears, and it has this fractal property. So what does it mean? Well, the fractal property means that the numbers of sites in the cluster is proportional to the system size to this power df, which for percolation in 2D happens to be this 1.89. Now, inside the gaps in the big cluster, we find little clusters, so we also have some power law distribution of cluster sizes. Now let's go on to this cheese model. What happens as we move away from the percolation threshold? Well, basically the spanning cluster becomes kind of stronger and stronger, but it has holes in it. And the typical size of this hole is the coherence length, which is determined by how far away we are from the fixed point. Inside this holes in the cheese live the smaller clusters. Similar thing happens on the other side, except now instead of the yellow cheese corresponding to no percolation cluster, we have this blue cheese which corresponds to the percolation to the big cluster, right? So this is a hole in a big cluster. This is just a small cluster, but both have a typical size. Sorry, I didn't explain that very well. Yeah, one is cheese and one is anti-cheese. There we go. Near criticality, this correlation length scales as distance to criticality to the new power, as usual. Now, what happens in our model? Well, in our model, we basically get the same thing. So here, I plot the distribution of cluster sizes as a function of cluster size. At criticality, I find a power law. As I move away from criticality, I see that the power law exists at small cluster sizes, but then curves over at large cluster sizes. This is true both in the glass phase and the superfluid phase. And we can indeed do scaling collapse of all this stuff and extract the critical exponents associated with the transition. Now, this is a kind of interesting plot. What do these percolating clusters actually look like? They don't look like they do in percolation theory. Here are some plots. from mode glass to critical to superfluid. So the points correspond to points that form big clusters, and the lines correspond to the J couplings that were merged to make up the cluster. So this kind of looks like small world networks. It's kind of cool. So in conclusion, in this section, we applied the strongest order RG both to a 3D classical model and the 2D quantum model. For the classical model, we found this sliding regime, and for the quantum model, we found the mode glass. And one important point is the transition from superfluid to mode glass is this new critical point that we described, but the transition from mode glass to mode insulator is just a Griffith transition.
What's the density of space for the
mode
glass? Like, is
there
what kind of power law?
So the density of space is not a power law. It's actually it's much much smaller. It goes down faster than any power law. How to explain this is if we look on the glass side. Basically, if you want to have a small gap, we need a large cluster. So here is a distribution of clusters. Say I pick this one, we see that clusters basically end up where log s is like 3.5. There are no clusters out here. So that's why the density of states goes down faster than power law.
So what
you
said
is a transition like percolation. Can you make that sharp? I mean, one could presume, so it's known what happens if I just take the pure boson quantum rotor problem on a percolation graph, right? There's some. Yes. Right, so the number of sites in the big cluster as a function of system size is different. So we have different fractal exponents as df. Okay, and then there is this final part.
One more question. So normally if I do RG and it's approximate, I want to find a way to make it exact. Maybe I do funny things like go near dimension 4 or add a bunch of components. Is there something analogous you can do here? You're getting a finite disorder fixed point. Can I tweak my Hamiltonian to turn it into infinite disorder?
1D is infinite disorder.
So that's the tweak you have to do.
But it's not a very helpful.
Is there like a 1 plus epsilon expansion here where you can expand around 1D?
I suppose yes, because we're actually working just on a random graph. But we haven't thought about it very clearly. Right? But we could do like 1 plus epsilon in the sense that we could have a graph which is almost 1D, but with some bonds that are outside the 1D. Just a quick point. We have played around with doing the same thing for many body excited states. And the idea here is that locally, when we look at the ground state, each time we would solve the small cluster and pick its ground state. But no one told us to do this. We could have picked an excited state. And in this way, as we go through RG, we could actually make a tree. We could either pick a ground state, we could pick some excited state, we could pick some other excited state for the local cluster as we are going up and up to bigger cluster sizes. So we tried this procedure on the eSIM model, and here's a comparison of the eigenvalues of the eSIM model with of the XY model. So here is a eigenvalue as a function of the eigenvalue number, comparison of exact diagonalization and RG, and they look very similar, indicating that the RG is basically getting the same values as exact diagonalization. So thank you for your attention.
We have a lot more questions.
Thank you.